State and Federal Affairs to order, July 18th, 2005, and open a work session on Senate Bill 1037. We want to talk a little bit today about, we've got the dash 19s and dash 20s. Can you tell us what they do, or?
Mr. Chair, I'd be glad to. The dash 19 amendments were provided to committee members and made available to the public last Friday. Those were submitted by Representative Gard at the request of the Association of Oregon Counties, I believe. What those do is those provide for transferability of waivers. The dash 20 amendments we received today, those were prepared by John Chandler, who's available to speak to those, and those would add county service districts to the list of cities, counties, and state.
Well, if Representative Garrard would like to hop up there, maybe John, you could get up there with him.
Go ahead and hop, Mr. Chairman.
Yeah.
On one leg.
Good afternoon, Mr. Chair. Good morning. I'm Representative Garrard from District 56, Climber Falls. I can speak to the dash 19s, which Patrick pretty well concisely described the amendment. It adds transferability to Senate Bill 1037. However, there are other issues with 1037. Those amendments are being drafted as we speak, but will not be ready until this afternoon. The dash 20s are Mr. Chandler's, and I will let him explain what the 20s do.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman and members of the committee. John Chandler, Oregon Home Builders Association. The dash 20s to Senate Bill 1037 would expand the list of covered entities to include county service districts organized under ORS 451. There's a number of these around the state. The most visible is Washington County's Clean Water Services. And frankly, the way the measure was drafted, there was a bit of a loophole here by not covering county service districts. If you look at Chapter 451, 010, the list of things that county service districts can do is pretty broad. They can do water, sewer, drainage, transportation, mass transit, et cetera, and so forth. And it's simply our fear that if this is not added and this loophole is not stapled shut, that a county somewhere, and none of them would do this, of course, because it would be in running the will of the people, but potentially a county could form special service districts to do much of their land use planning and by so doing avoid the implications of Measure 37, which we certainly think would be impolite if not improper. So we brought these amendments forward. In the dash 20s also it provides that this would only be on a prospective basis. It's not our intention to undo anything that has been done by Clean Water Services or any other entity, but simply to apply on a going forward basis that they would be covered by the same same law as applies to cities, counties, metro, and the state. During our work session on this bill and its progeny in the House, we discussed this with the cities, counties, and with Washington County in particular, the language that's in front of you. I emailed it to them last week. I have not heard back. I believe they're fine with it. As far as I know, they're fine. I've heard nothing to the contrary. They were fine when it was being discussed under House Bill 3120. And with that, I'll hush and take any questions you might have.
I'll call in now. Committee members, have any requests?
Representative, just a quick comment. The dash 19s, which you just explained, and then the dash 20s, are they being worked into whatever future amendment there is so that these can be overlaid and actually done, or are they standalone amendments?
Chair Krieger, Representative Boquist, yes. Everything with the amendments we're expecting to have done this afternoon, there'll be 24 different items that will be changed in Senate Bill 1037 that should include, will include the 19th. I'm not sure whether Mr. Chandler has checked as to whether 20 is covered or not, but the 19th certainly will be, and the corrections that we feel are very important to 1037 will also be included.
Thank you.
Well, I apologize, Mr. Chair, for arriving late, and I have to say that I could use probably a little primer on the B-20s, but I'm reluctant to drag the rest of the committee through that.
They're not going to be moved today.
Okay, that gives
me... I'll give you time to study.
I appreciate that, Mr. Chair.
Thank you. Anything further?
Okay, thank you, gentlemen.
Thank you.
Thank you.
Senator Ringo.
Thank you very much. Good morning, everybody. I'm Senator Charlie Ringo, District 17. I put forth just a little bit of blood and sweat on Measure 37, and I appreciate the work Representative Garrard has done on this. And I just wanted to leave a couple thoughts with the committee in considering these amendments. I think both of these amendments are intended to address some deficiencies with Measure 37 and some ways some flaws with Measure 37. One is the transferability issue, and the other is the issue concerning special service districts. And in the negotiations that we had on the Senate side, we considered both of those, and in different versions we addressed those. But this is really, really complicated. You know, the first three words of the Measure 37 ballot title were "government must pay." That's what it said, government must pay. And I think if you really get to, well, what's the intent of the voters, somewhere in there was an effort for a compensation or a thought of compensation mechanism. And one of the drafts we had on the Senate side would have clarified transferability, clarified the special service district issue, but also made an effort towards a compensation mechanism. I think it was just too complicated for us to make that, I guess, the grand compromise and clarify things here, compensation mechanism here, reel in some of the more offensive Measure 37 claims, the claims on the very best farmland. I think it was just too controversial and too complicated for us to get there. What we passed out of the House, and is what you have before you, is really intended to be pretty neutral. It's intended to help cities and counties by clarifying some of the ambiguities in Measure 37, excuse me, and it's also intended to help claimants in some ways. For example, it caps what local governments can charge for application fees. It caps it at $1,000. And also by specifying what claimant information claimants need to provide, it helps them have some clarity over the system. My discussions with Dave Honeycutt a couple of weeks ago, I said, you know, Dave, you can add transferability. I think it's going to lead to a non-concurrence in the Senate, and then where's that going to leave us? Conference committee, I suppose. I hope is what we get out of this session is something that at least clarifies some of the ambiguities of Measure 37 in a way that is pretty neutral. Because if it's something that facilitates Measure 37 claims but without a compensation mechanism, it won't get through the Senate. If it takes away a bunch of Measure 37 claims or weakens Measure 37, it won't get through the House. But I think there's something in the middle that we can do that really makes sense. And so I just ask you to consider that as we move forward from here, and regardless of what this committee does when there's further discussions on Measure 37, I hope we can do something that is pretty neutral. It doesn't facilitate Measure 37 claims, doesn't take away Measure 37 claims, but it gives clarity to everybody involved that I think is desperately needed. So that's where I hope we go. And it's what I'd like to pass out. I have a sheet, and I probably should have stamped my name on it. This is just a one-pager, and I'm not going to take credit for it. It was prepared by Linda Ludwig, by one of her assistants, the League of Oregon Cities. It just talks about, this is the Senate Bill 1037, benefits to claimants, state and local governments, as it's currently written. And again, I think this kind of clarity would be beneficial to everyone concerned, no matter where you are in the land use wars.
Committee members, do you have any comments or...
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Senator Ringo, the feeling is mutual in regards to the effort that you put forth on this bill. 1037, in my opinion at this point, I'd like to know whether you agree or not, really does clarify some things, but it clarifies them only from the state, county, and perhaps city perspective. It does not really deal with clarifying the people's issues with 1037.
Well, for one thing, it tells them what information they need to file when they file a claim, and I think that's useful. I mean, if you're applying for a driver's license, you have to fill out a form, and I think that's helpful. And this does the same thing. You know, the one thing I didn't mention is the tractor record portion, which I think is also helpful for people who want to build one house. You know, when I talk to Dave Honeycutt, he says, well, as currently written, 1037 is less favorable to claimants in a couple of respects. One is the attorney fees provision. I said, fine, put the attorney fees provision back in, if that's what you think it needs to be neutral. Another one is it takes away claims from coastal areas, shorelines, estuaries. I said, okay, if you find that offensive, take that part out. Let's do what we need to do to make measure 37, to make 1037 so it really is neutral. So it doesn't hinder anybody that has Measure 37 rights, but rather it just provides some clarity and some structure. So I think those kind of amendments are called for. Going for the big things, though, like transferability, you know, as we've talked about, those will rain fire down on a lot of us on the Senate side, and we're never going to get that bill out of here. So I just that's my pitch.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Senator Ringo, in the main, it does appear to me that the scaled-down version of 1037 as it came from the Senate is procedural and doesn't attempt to address sort of the larger substantive issues about how Measure 37 works, and I think I applaud that as a fallback position if we can't get to the sort of broader consensus. The one piece that doesn't seem to be consistent with that is the tract of record provision. Yeah. It does seem to me that one element was added in that is it is a major concession from those who are trying to generally defend our natural resource base against development pressure, and that would be in some measure development pressure. And so I wanted to hear from you why you think it was important for that piece to be included in what's otherwise a procedural bill.
Yes, no, that's a good question. I think there were two reasons to include the tractor record. One of them is that I do believe that a lot of the frustration with our land use system that caused people to vote for Measure 37 was the inability to build one house. People owned a parcel of property, and government imposed regulations that prevented them from building one house that they wanted to live in. And I think that's far different than a developer who wants to put up 100 houses. But that frustration of not being able to build one house, I think, is significant. And this would let people build one house, at least if a certain window of regulations prevented them from doing so. And it would let them build that one house without even filing a Measure 37 claim. They don't have to go through the Measure 37 claims process. They don't have to file an application fee. They don't have to wait 180 days. And they don't have the uncertainty over transferability. So I think in terms of trying to do the right thing for the people of the state of Oregon, which hopefully now and then that's what we try to do around here, I think that really it does make sense. The other thing is, I think in terms of increasing the political feasibility of the bill. You know, I think it really is intended to be a concession to those who want to loosen up our land use system in at least some measure.
Follow up if I could.
Hold on.
And I recognize that it may be an important element in trying to get a sort of broader consensus. I'm just a little concerned about sort of volunteering it without substantive compromise on the other side. It takes what is a procedural bill that was really, I think, quite neutral but for that provision, and it really provides something that's pretty significant that people have been trying to get to, who are trying to loosen our land use laws. You know, you and I both grew up within a few miles of each other, and what you were a town kid and I was a country kid, and what I observed out in the farming community I grew up in is that there were some homes that were being constructed, oftentimes for a relative who worked in town of the farm family. But, you know, those houses never got torn down when that person moved someplace else. It really added another home that then people valued generally because it was out in the country, and people who wanted country living, even if they didn't have any connection to the natural resource activities, would choose to live there. And it may be that you know, creating this sort of safety valve piece is an important part of the ultimate compromise and to the Measure 37 problem. But I have to say, I was disappointed to see this included in the bill at this stage in the process, because if there's nothing I see that sort of counterbalancing it.
It's a give me without a get.
Yes, exactly.
I don't dispute that, other than I think it. I think it is good policy for our state, and if we can do good policy, let's do it.
Okay. Thank you, Mr. Chair.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Representative McPherson, just in a quick response, there is the procedural portion of 1037 is, when you describe it as neutral, that is a very subjective statement. There are those on the other side, the pro-37 people, who feel that the give that you were looking for is in the procedures, and some of the amendments that will be coming will be more illustrative of that point. I wanted to ask Senator Ringo, in Mr. Shetterly's comments last Friday, he indicated that LCDC would support transferability with a cap, and I was wondering if you had an opinion on that.
I don't have an opinion. I don't. A cap in terms of the number of dwelling units? I don't know. Representative Gard, I'd need to understand the details of that. I mean, the transferability issue, some people think they're about to find a way around it anyway. I mean, we've had those discussions. I don't know is the short answer.
Okay.
Just a quick question for Senator. You had indicated that our job, obviously, is to do the right thing for the people of Oregon, but tying that with the political reality, have you heard from a lot of folks by email communication, phone calls, and or letters regarding the addressing their concern about the transferability piece?
I've received an unbelievable amount of communication. There are some, I've received one, in fact, I like this email so much I stuck it on my bulletin board. It said, and this is one who did not want us to clarify transferability. This is even though we were preventing claims from going in on the best farmland, we were allowing transferability and therefore facilitating claims in other areas. This email said that if the bill passed, it was the end of everything we love about Oregon, and I'm not exaggerating. So there are people who say, yes, please clarify transferability. There are those who say, absolutely not. Don't clarify transferability. Don't facilitate these claims.
Follow up. Well, I would just comment that I have received an overwhelming number of people that say we must address this. And so whether I guess, and I understand that is the debate that needs to be had, but again, putting the best interest of the people of Oregon over the political issue.
No, I think that's what we're here for, but I would go back to, you know, the ballot title said government must pay, and there are a lot of people who said they didn't expect wholesale waivers, they expected compensation, and that if we're really here to fulfill the will of the voters with respect to Measure 37, then we need to have a compensation mechanism.
Anything further?
Thank you very much.
Thank you. Okay, we'll close the work session on Senate Bill 1037 and open a work session on Senate Bill 591. Senator Plavansky.
Chair.
Have the staff talk to us a little bit about the work group and the amendment that we've got now, which is almost like a gut and stuff, isn't it?
It is.
Yeah.
Chair Krieger, members of the committee, the Dash 3 amendment should be in your files. It was distributed on Friday. And the Dash 3 has come about as a result of the conversation that we had in committee on the 13th of July about this bill, where we reviewed the three different statutes in Chapter 811 of the traffic code that discuss when a vehicle must stop for a pedestrian. And the direction that the committee gave me was to see if we could revise Senate Bill 591 with language that would address all three of those circumstances where a pedestrian is walking through a marked or unmarked crosswalk, signal or unsignalized crosswalk, and specifically also where vehicles were making turns into crosswalks. So the Dash 3 attempts to address all three of those issues. And it applies, and it also addresses the issue which was in 591, which is how do you define the adjacent lane of travel when it comes to a parking strip or a bike path. The 591 essentially, in the dash 3 of 591, essentially that is the language that was in Senate Bill 492, which passed the Senate and was referred to the House Transportation Committee. And 492 is stuffed now into 591 with a change of this definition of the adjacent lane of travel for purposes of the parking strip or bike path. Let me give a shot at explaining what the dash 3 does. The rule essentially is the vehicle needs to stop when the pedestrian is in the lane of travel or the lane adjacent to the lane of travel. The bike lane, the parking strip that is adjacent to the lane of travel, counts as the lane of travel. And that is the rule for signaled, unsignaled, marked crosswalk, unmarked crosswalk. The separate rule is when the vehicle is turning at a signalized crosswalk. And in that circumstance, the vehicle must stop if the pedestrian is in the lane of travel or within 6 feet of the lane of travel. That is, I believe, what the dash 3 accomplishes.
Okay, committee members?
Yeah, Mr. Chair, the question for staff first, and then I'll get for a reaction from Senator Przanski. Looking at the top of page 2, it looks like we resolved the status of a bicycle lane or parking section in accordance with the bill, the first version of 591 that came forward to us, rather than treating it as a separate lane so that it would have the effect of, in our four-lane example up there, which is helpful enough and left in the blackboard, it would require not only the nearest travel lane, but the next over travel lane to stop and remain stopped while a pedestrian is in either that parking section or the bicycle lane.
Representative McPherson, I believe that's right.
Uncontrolled.
Right. When there's not a traffic control device, right. When it's and when it's a straight shot situation. If it's turning, it's a different situation.
Only if it's turning at a signalized crosswalk,
yes, yes.
Then it's a lane plus 6 feet.
Yes.
So that gives I recall Representative Krieger talking about this intersection, the signalized intersection where the cars are backed up trying to turn because they have to wait till the pedestrian gets the whole way over to the opposite curb. Under the dash 3, the vehicle turning would only have to wait until the pedestrian was through the lane of travel plus 6 feet into the next lane and then could begin to turn.
And I would support the bill if there's a consensus in favor of it, but I also would be comfortable with a version that said that it was a separate lane rather than part of the adjacent travel lane, so that in our example that the left-hand lane, travel lane, wouldn't have to stop until the pedestrian actually entered the travel lane that was nearest. Do you follow that?
The way I think about it is that the function of this, of the dash 3, is that parking strip and that bike lane is collapses into one lane that includes the first lane of travel.
Yes, yes, right.
So when the pedestrian steps foot into the parking strip, that is considered the first lane of travel. In the four-way diagram that I have on the chalkboard, the next lane over of travel also must stop.
Well, now if I could ask Senator Przanski, this is consistent with what you brought forward. I think your main aim was to get clarity rather than necessarily to make a particular policy choice. I think I recall that from our last discussion. So the question is, do you favor this version as opposed to if we were to say, have the amendment revised so that it would be treated as a separate lane and it wouldn't be until the pedestrian entered the first of the travel lanes that then a next over travel lane would be required to stop?
Chair Krieger and Representative McPherson, I believe
preferred what we have before us for a couple of reasons. One, I think it gives the clarity, and it will in fact provide for, in the scenario that we're looking at, where it's not a signalized area straightaway, that both those lanes in the four lane would actually need to be stopping that on that same direction. I also think it really addresses what Chair Krieger wanted to make certain that we didn't see was the backup, all those turns. And that's why I think the six-foot rule is more appropriate. If I heard Representative McPherson, you're saying maybe as an alternative, go ahead and require that next lane where that six-foot lane rule might be applied would also have to stop until they cleared, if that's what you were insinuating.
No, I wasn't. The turning situation, I wasn't commenting on that at all. I think we've captured where we want to be on the turning situation.
Right.
It was only on the non-turning situation, kind of going back to the first version of 591 that came before us was on this non-turning, unsignalized, straight shot situation. And as I say, I could be... I could favor another version, but if this is the version you prefer, and if that also is supported within the committee, I'm fine with it. And I think that the main positive result we've achieved is by getting those other changes brought in. I mean, this is kind of a detail on bike lane, parking strip as compared to the main turning situation.
In Curry County, if you let me get out of here, I won't have to deal with this.
That's right.
You let me go home. Senator Provansky, you want to tell us anything else on this?
No, Mr. Chair, the dash threes, I think, capture everything that this committee asked for Mr. O'Leary to work on it with my assistance by bringing in SB 492 and making that clarification currently on page 2, lines 2 through 4. I think really sets forth exactly the obligations of a driver. And I think it's very clear that we're going to make certain that when a person steps off that sidewalk into a bike lane or a park lane, they're going to have the safety as if they were stepping into the lane of travel.
Okay, thank you.
Mr. Chair, I'd like to move the A3 amendment to the bill.
Representative Boquist has moved the dash 3 amendments into Senate Bill 591. Any objections? Therein.
Mr. Chair, I'd like to move Senate Bill 591 as amended to the floor with a due pass.
Representative Boquist has moved Senate Bill 591 as amended to the floor with a due pass. Any further discussion? Hearing none. Okay. We're doing our vote. We'll be right down. Go ahead and call the roll.
Representative Barker?
Aye.
Representative Boquist?
Aye.
Representative Flores? Excuse?
Yeah, fine.
Mr. Chair?
She's excused.
Representative McPherson?
Aye.
Chair Krieger?
Aye. Senate Bill 591 is amended, moves the floor with a due pass, and Representative Barker will carry. Closes that bill, closes the committee, and we are on a call.
Thank you. When do we need to come tomorrow?